Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Good day. Welcome back to New Books in History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. My name is Charles Cotillo of the Royal Historical Society. I'm a host on the channel, and today I'm pleased and honored to have with us Professor Jeremy Black. Professor Black is professor of history at Exeter University. He is without a doubt the most prolific historian writing in the English language today, having written well over 100 books. Actually, Professor Black, exactly how many books have you written? Do you know?
I don't know. I have no idea. There was a party when I reached 100, and there was a previous party when it reached my age. I suspect it's about 145, but I don't count.
Understood. Today,
let me just say something. Say something very briefly. Of people comment on the number of books. I don't think it makes you a better or a worse author to write a lot or a little. I hope that when I die, if the obituarists think I'm worthy of comment, they will comment on the range of the scholarship, the sophistication of the intellectual analysis, and the willingness repeatedly to look at a broad approach to history. That, I think, is much more important than how many or how few books one writes.
Point well taken. Today, we are speaking about Professor Black's book, A Brief History of Spain. Welcome, Professor Black. And to jump right in, how does geography impact the history of Spain, the history of the Iberian Peninsula?
Oh, well, geography is extraordinarily important. I mean, Spain we think of as a unit, but of course, for much of its history, there were a number of kingdoms, and it faced in very different directions. If you go, for example, to the northwest, to Galicia, it's a totally different environment to the southeast, to near Valencia. And you will find that there are different Spains. And of course, one can think about this even more strongly because prior to the development of rapid transit systems, in a sense, Barcelona was closer to Marseille or to Genoa than it was to, shall we say, Badajoz or Seville. And I think this is important. We tend to assume the units that are there. But in the case of Iberia, it was not inevitable that there would be two countries, Spain and Portugal, nor was it inevitable that if there was going to be a Spain, it should be a Spain with the geography that it has, political geography it has at the present moment.
What is the earliest evidence of human settlement in the Iberian Peninsula?
Oh, you go right back. I mean, the same as with France, you've got these rather wonderful cave paintings which show, a understanding of quite sophisticated ability to produce what we would call art. I mean, clearly, if you go back further, you can see hominids and Neanderthals with traces in similar cave systems, for example, in Gibraltar. But Spain, as an environment, had more to offer in a way than areas further north. I mean, as the ice sheets, and obviously there wasn't just one ice age, there were a series of ice ages or ice sheet advances. As the ice sheets retreated and the warmth came up from the south, so did the animals which human beings pursued in hunting societies. There was a land bridge between what is now Spain and Morocco. The Mediterranean was a lake, and transit from North Africa to Iberia was easy. And of course, that meant animals moved north. It also means deciduous trees moved north, and it means that the waters, particularly off Mediterranean Spain, also warm up, which means that you've got sea life that you can exploit. So Spain, in some respects, you're going to be seeing more early life there than if you were looking at, say, Denmark.
What is the contemporary Spanish view of the Roman conquest and subsequent rule of the Iberian Peninsula?
Well, as you know, I try and discuss that in my book. I mean, what's interesting about Spanish views of their own past is where people have chosen to focus on. So the idea of Spain as an imperial power, which was a very attractive idea from the late 15th century onwards, was one that was deliberately designed to resonate with Rome. And indeed, there was also, because of Christianization in late Roman Hispania, there was also a resonance with the Christian, the very explicit nature of Christianity in the ideology of the Spanish state. On the other hand, there were always some who focused on pre-Spanish Celts, and also separately, but sometimes at the same time, some people who found that the Visigoths, who, as it were, overran much of Spain, were in a sense exemplary. And you know, it's rather interesting. And if you go to the flag of the province of the city of Zamora, there is a statue of Viriathus, who was the leader of the Lusitani, one of the tribes that fought against Roman expansion. And there was a television series between 210 and 212 in his honor. I think it's fair to say you would not have anticipated that during, if you'd been visiting Spain during Franco's period. So a lot of it does depend upon the politics of the society that comes comes later. I mean, Franco himself was relatively keen on the Visigoths because they established unity in the peninsula, and also because they converted to Catholicism. And indeed, a museum devoted to them was established during his dictatorship. But after his death, they fell somewhat out of favor. So, you know, you've got different histories of Spain in the past, which reflects the extent to which, like modern day Britain or France or Germany or the United States, it is a divided society with what you might call history wars or culture wars. And the past resonates very much. But as a last point there, the past that probably resonates the most in terms of divisiveness, and I'm sure we'll come to that, is the past of the last century, particularly the Civil War and the Franco era, but also prior to that. And I think it's fair to say that the amount of popular interest in whether Spain should look back to Hispania is much less pronounced than that which focuses on Franco.
What explains the rapid fall of Visigoth Spain to the Muslims in the, I think it's early 8th century?
It is the early 8th century. The Muslims crossed the Straits of Gibraltar in 711. Well, it depended upon whom you read at the time. I mean, for example, Christian writers at the time, like Beatus, were arguing that this was, you know, a providential punishment for the wicked last king of Visigothic Spain, Roderick, you know, that morality played a role. And in a sense, in taking that view, he was echoing the standard approach in the Book of Kings towards the kings of Israel and the moralist accounts that were taken. I think there are other factors. First of all, there's the actual dynamism of expanding Islam, and in particular, its syncretic habits, its ability to draw on the Berbers of Northwest Africa and to use them. Secondly, I think it's fair to say that the Visigoths at that stage had divisions. They had other military commitments, including they'd been fighting the Basques. So there are a number of factors. And it's also worth bearing in mind that, without trying to find something specifically at fault in Visigothic Spain, it's worth bearing in mind that the Islamic forces had also conquered, Byzantine Egypt or Sassanid Persia. So it's not specifically something to Spain alone that explains this expansion.
Do you agree with those revisionist Spanish historians who argue that the so-called convivencia, I'm not sure I'm pronouncing it correctly, was for the most part a myth, and has more to say about contemporary ideas of multiculturalism than the actualities of Spain in that period of time?
Yes, I think that's correct. I mean, what you're referring to, as you know, is the multi-ethnic, multi-religious, yet supposedly tolerant culture of Al-Andalus, and in particular in the late 10th century. I think one has to be careful here. I mean, the Kingdom of Al-Andalus also spent its time brutalizing and raiding the Christians in northern, northwestern Spain. Not that they were not doing the same back. And I don't think I think one has to be very careful. It tells you more about a modern belief or wish belief that it is possible to have an essentially benign, tolerant Islam in which an enormous amount of political and intellectual capital has been endowed. As you say, there are revisionist Spanish historians who are skeptical about this, and I think that's reasonable. I think the actual practice of Islamic Spain, as indeed of Christian Spain, I have to add, was one in which violence and notions of masculinity centered on violence were very, very important. The fact that they didn't spend all their time fighting the infidel and at times fought each other, the same also true of the Christians, of course, does not mean that the notion of religious warfare didn't play an important part in molding these societies. And it's also worth bearing in mind, before somebody goes around and idealizing Al-Andalus, or for that matter, the Islamic society in Sicily, that these were slave societies and the conditions of slavery were not particularly attractive. And slavery was supported by slave raiding. So that doesn't tend to be talked about very much. And that's very interesting, isn't it? Because, you have this astonishing idea that slavery was in some way a Western innovation. I recently heard, I was at a lecture at the British Library, and I heard an American so-called scholar claiming that the British had invented slavery. Well, that might play well with a political sort of self-loathing of part of the audience. But in practicality, of course, slavery has a very, very old history. And, if you're looking at the world of Islam in the medieval period, slavery was extraordinarily important to it.
Unfortunately, the morass, intellectual morass of political correctness knows no bounds, unfortunately, in terms of inexactitude and mendacity. Why did the Kingdom of Granada, the last Muslim kingdom in the south of Spain, last so long?
That's a fascinating question. I think, first of all, I think Christian Spain, as indeed Europe as a whole, was much weakened in its energy levels by the Black Death and by the outbreaks of plague that followed that. Secondly, Castile, under its ruling dynasty from 1369 to 1516, had enormous instability, conflict within the royal family as well as within the nobility, an overlap of the two, conflict with Portugal. I think those were important. And also, the Kingdom of Granada was no real threat. I mean, once Andalusia had been conquered, once in particular Seville had gone once the counterattack by the Marinid Sultanate of Morocco had been defeated, and it was decisively defeated in 1340 at the Battle of Salado. Then thereafter, I think it's fair to say that Granada was very much a sort of, a sub-story. And I think what's interesting is that the dynastic union of the ruling houses of Aragon and Castile in the persons of Ferdinand and Isabella in, I think that's 1479, is the prelude to attacking Granada. And they start off, I think it's Ronda falls in 1485 and Granada itself in 1492. In other words, Spanish unification, once it comes, readily is followed by the fall of Granada because it was no real threat. And of course, as you know, Spain and indeed Portugal, which had captured Ceuta in 1415, but Spain as well then immediately expands into North Africa. There is no sense whatsoever that the sea is a barrier. I think this is very important. You know, modern notions of what should be the barrier for a state, society, or people don't mean very much for most of history. And to the Spanish rulers taking over Granada, where the bulk of the population remained, I mean, those of them who were Moors and then Moriscos were eventually expelled, but the bulk of them remained as a kind of subject servile labor force, offered an obvious pattern for then moving on into North Africa. And it's instructive as to what would have happened, where the boundaries would have lasted had there not been a revival of the the Moroccan monarchies, Sultanate in the 1560s and 70s, and also the expansion of the Ottoman Turks into modern-day Algeria from the late 1520s, both of which stop it. So, as you know, Spain has two enclaves in North Africa, Ceuta, which it got as a result. It was the prize, if you like, once it lost Portugal. But Melilla, those are still Spanish to this day, but they represent shadows of what had been a much greater aspiration to be a North African power.
You explain Spain's 16th century conquest in the America as being akin to similar conquests around the world, in particular the Mughals in the Indian subcontinent and the Ottomans in the Levant and in Egypt, as well as further west in the beginning of the 16th century. Can you expand on that a bit in terms of this comparisons?
Yes, I think, first of all, I'm not unique in explaining that. There was a very distinguished American scholar, William H. McNeill, wrote a great book on gunpowder empires in which he looked at comparisons, and that was some decades ago. But what I was arguing in particular, I don't believe we should explain this in terms of military technology, though I have discussed that in other books. But I think an important point was the ability of these societies, and there was only a relatively modest number of Spaniards or Portuguese who went to the New World, only a relatively modest number of Mughals, etc. It's the ability to win over local elites. So the Spaniards, of course, in the New World actually win over quite a few of the local aristocracy. They kill others, but they will win over quite a few. And as long as they're willing to convert to Christianity, and obviously Christianity often absorbs existing cults by sanctifying the local deities, that's relatively easy. And the same thing happens with the Mughals, who recruit, for example, the Rajputs, or with the Ottomans, who use, you mentioned Egypt, they use Mamluk troops and administrators. So the kind of modern notion in which you have an engaged and mobilized mass public is really, for most countries, I think you could fairly say it's true of the 20th century. For some countries with mass literacy and nationalist movements, it's true from the 19th century. I mean, the interesting thing about the United States and Britain is that you can see such a popular nationalism earlier, as indeed you can in the Swiss cantons, for example, or Venice. But these are unusual societies. No accidents. Those are the societies which are the basis of liberty, freedom, and the rule of law. Societies which are much more imperial structures, reliant on local cooperation, have generally a much more nuanced form in which it's of rulership, in which it's very necessary for the, as it were, the government to give the elite the instructions that the elite wishes to follow, and the elite to ensure that the government knows what instructions it wants. And, you know, rather sort of foolish people sometimes refer to that as absolutism or, you know, autocracy or whatever. It's actually much more complex than that. And it is reliant on consent, but the consent is scarcely equal. And much of the, you know, much of the population is not in any way consulted in it.
You seem to disagree with the historical literature, which posits that in the century after 1590s, there was a so-called decline of Spain. Why so?
Well, first of all, not all historians take that view. I mean, I think it's fair to say that people who have written about the difficulties of Spain have nevertheless seen a degree of resilience in the late 17th century. I'm thinking of Henry Kane, and even more significantly, Christopher Storrs, who's written a rather good book on Spain under Charles II and then gone on to do good work on Spain under Philip V. I mean, what I would say is that it all is far too pat and convenient, you know, the sort of the decline of Spain, the ascendancy of France. It reflected in part, and I've tried to argue this in an earlier book I did on Europe from 1550 to 1800, it reflected, in fact, putting together of what was known as the Black Legend of Anti-Catholicism, a view that in some way Spain was clearly and obviously anachronistic and failed, which is a rather odd way to describe the society, which in the 1690s was one of the largest empires in the world. And, you know, the a misunderstanding of the nature of historical sources. I mean, there were, as you know, Spanish writers called the Obispos who wrote about the serious problems of Spain in the early 17th century. And they were serious problems. But so also were there serious problems in Russia of the time of troubles, or in France of the 1610s, and then again of the Fronde, or in England and Scotland in the of the internecine political quarrels of the 17th century. So I think there's an element of failure to put it into contextual terms. And, you know, I remember giving lectures on this years ago to undergraduates and saying to them, you know, if you look at the standard image historian after historian has cited to describe Spain as in chaos, they describe Don Quixote and tilting at the windmills, and the idea of here is a republic of the bewitched, or a state of delusion, and all of these terms have been run out. And I used to say to the students, you know, which character and which novel by, say, Iris Murdoch would you like to be used to sum up your experience, those of your parents, and those of the next generation? I don't think people have always been sufficiently careful in their use of sources in discussing the travails of 17th century Spain. And if I might just comment on a great historian who I much admire, J.H. Eliot. He wrote an enormous book on the revolt of the Catalans, very influential. I remember reading it when I was undergraduate. And, you know, if you chuck it out the first floor of my house, you could kill somebody on the ground floor, on the ground, you know, outside the house. But the fact that it's a big book. But nobody, not him, not any of the other British scholars or American scholars writing on the period, or French scholars writing on the period, wrote a comparable book called The Reconquest of Catalonia. Yes, Catalonia rebelled in 1640. It was a big problem. But it's worth bearing in mind that it had been recaptured by 1652-53. And, you know, people didn't want to listen to that narrative. The same if you look at, you know, sort of British raiding on the Spanish Caribbean, or what you would call the Caribbean in the late 16th century. We all played up Sir Francis Drake, and people talked about for the English and then subsequently for the Dutch, if you're looking into, I think it's 1629, raids on the Spanish treasure fleets. Yes, these were impressive. But the fact of the matter is the vast bulk of Spain's Caribbean empire remained. Most of the silver got through. And when the English did launch major attacks, they were often unsuccessful. I mean, they gained Jamaica, having failed to gain Hispaniola. Jamaica was largely uninhabited at that time. Going into the 18th century, they failed at Cartagena in 1741. And there was much more resilience in the Spanish Empire than we tend to accept. And again, I mean, it's worth looking at the situation in the mid-18th century, background to the American Revolution. Yes, Spain did badly in 1762, the British capturing both Havana and Manila that year, but the French hadn't exactly done marvellously in the Seven Years' War. They'd lost Quebec, Montreal, Guadeloupe, Martinique, etc. And of course, if you look at the Spanish part of the War of American Independence, the Spaniards did jolly well. They captured from the British Mobile, Pensacola. You know, their intervention was quite important. It's just we don't tend to talk about it. So I think what we do is we have this very convenient account which plays strongly to what we know is to happen. We know that what is to happen is that Spain doesn't remain at the forefront politically, and that it declines in relative terms economically. We know that, so we make that appear inevitable or very, very, very likely without looking at multiple contingencies and without trying to relativize that. And as you will know, Charles, I've had the pleasure of talking to you on a number of occasions. I think this is more generally true of the way in which we look at history. I think it's part of the Whiggish or progressivist or whatever term you want to use, a narrative that is so strong as an analytical method in historical work. And, you know, I find it unconvincing. Or let's put it like this. At times it may well be accurate, but that doesn't mean it's ipso facto accurate. And I think it's generally more complex. And 17th century Spain is definitely more complex.
Yes, and I agree with you that Sir John Eliot is a great historian. I've done a podcast with him. But you are correct. The subtitle to his book is an episode in the decline of Spain. So there you have the sort of Whiggish teleological view of Spanish
teleology. I mean, that crisis, Spain faces, as you will know, mid-17th century crisis. It faces rebellion in Catalonia, rebellion in Portugal, rebellion in Naples, rebellion in Sicily, long-term difficulties in a war with France, and actually conspiracies in Andalusia. All of those are overcome apart from the rebellion in Portugal. And the rebellion in Portugal lasts essentially because the Spaniards focus on Catalonia, and then because in the 1660s, both the English and the French intervene on the Portuguese side. So Spain is up against a lot. But what is interesting is that the Spanish monarchy remains the possessor of much of Western Europe until the dynasty ends in the male line, which is what happens in 1700. And that's why the Spanish succession is such an enormous prize. The war that in the United States you call Queen Anne's War, we call the War of the Spanish Succession, reflects the importance of Spain's legacy, that there is so much there to play for.
I agree entirely. And of course, when you were an undergraduate, of course, all this difficulties were put under the heading the crisis of the mid-17th century.
Yes, it was. It was indeed. And there was a sort of very developmental account of things. And I've written a book on Europe 1550 to 1800, and I've tried to suggest, I mean, others will have different views, that's fine, a different narrative and account of that. But the main point I would try and underline for listeners is to take everything, including what I say, as part of an interactive debate in which informed scholars are coming up with differing views, and therefore avoid anybody who says that theirs is a definitive account, because there is no such thing. And particularly when one's trying to address a society of the complexity of Spain, because to loop back to what we were talking at the beginning, Spain in part was an amalgam of different economies, different political cultures, and therefore you've got to be very wary of assuming you're looking at a unitary condition for whatever you mean by Spain, and obviously you probably need to, if you're meaning Spain, to include Spain's at least European empire, if not its transoceanic empire. This is, means very different things within itself at any one time.
Well, going to the early 19th century, why were the French, militarily speaking, unsuccessful in the Napoleonic period, but quite successful in 1823 in the so-called Army of Saint-Louis?
That's, again, an excellent question. I mean, what I would say is it's an issue of the impact of the situation domestically. When the French intervened in 1823, they were intervening on the side of the king and Ferdinand, and with much of the public behind the king and against the liberals. And also, it was a very short-run intervention. There was no army of occupation left. The problem with Napoleon's earlier intervention is whether or not it could have been done differently politically in the short term. He made the terrible mistake of trying to leave it as a long-term intervention. So instead of marching his troops in, imposing or at least molding a new political situation and then clearing out, which would have been much more sensible, he leaves an occupation, because it has to sustain his brother, who has no traction in Spanish politics or Spanish culture. He leaves his brother there. And then on top of that, there is an anti-clerical situation. I remember when I was last in Seville, going round monasteries that had been, of which the church remained, but monasteries, if you read it, all the stuff that they left up there, they'd been despoiled by French troops, or the French had, shoveled their horses in there and this sort of thing. And it's not surprising locals didn't like that. I mean, Spain was, in many senses, a profoundly Catholic country, something the liberals didn't really understand in 1823. And indeed, I think it's fair to say that, we've been talking about revisionism. A direction of revisionism, obviously very uncomfortable to many people who have views on the present politics, but, you shouldn't allow your views on the present politics to determine one's assessment of the past. What seems to be the case is that older views about much of Europe being progressive and waiting after Napoleon to sort of, as it were, greet Risorgimento and secularism and middle-class liberal governments, that doesn't actually appear so much to be the case. I mean, I was reading a rather good book by Laban, I think his name was, on Lombardy under the Austrians, which was Lombardy and the Veneto, which was making the point about the general popularity of the Austrians and the extent to which French rule had been compromised by all these Italians being dragged off to fight the Russians in 1812. And I think you could say the same thing about Italy. Same thing about Spain. Napoleon's the domestic policy of the Napoleonic system in Spain was cack-handed at best, exploitative as a whole, and really paid no attention to Spanish sensibilities. And, Charles Esdale's excellent work, and there are Spanish scholars, but it's possibly most accessible to your audiences by reading Charles Esdale. Charles Esdale's excellent work has drawn attention repeatedly to the strength of the Spanish regular forces, army forces, in fighting the French. That is intended to make it clear that although the British played a very major role, they were not the sole reason for the defeat of Napoleon. And I think, again, diachronic history, looking from one period to another, is always tricky. But just as an idea, you can make the same analogy when one's thinking, for example, of the Carlist Wars of the mid-19th century or the Spanish Civil War of 1936 to 1939, in that it's too attractive, particularly for outside commentators, to focus on the role of external intervention. And it tends to be underplayed that these wars were essentially determined by those who were, who are natives.
You appear not to adhere to what I characterize, maybe other people characterize as well, the Raymond Carr school of Spanish history, which sees Spain in the post-1815 period up to the early 20th century as being on the margins of European history, as an outlier, as a sort of semi-failed state?
Well, Spain has difficulties. We know that. We know it is difficult to establish practices of seeing the alternation of political power as being something that can be achieved peacefully. We know there is the practice of generals staging, the translation is pronouncements, but basically military demonstrations to demand the political power. We know that the economy didn't proceed at a fantastic rate. But, you know, I've written this in between writing a book on Italy, and the next one in the sequence is on Portugal. And I think if you're looking at that context, you're not assuming that Spain should behave like Denmark or the Netherlands. And I think there is a problem in assuming a greater degree of failure in the system. I think that is a problem. There were difficulties. It didn't match the leading economic players in Europe, and it was affected by tensions and difficulties in the global economy, particularly in the late 19th century, the result of agricultural imports into Europe. But no, I would be cautious about arguing that there is some ineluctable reason why the monarchy should fail, or subsequently, indeed, there is an ineluctable reason why the republic should fail. I'm not convinced about that. And, you know, the Spanish state, I mean, it, in many senses, undesirably so, is sometimes capable of major efforts. I mean, they suppressed the first major rising in Cuba in the early 1860s. Spain is acting as it's sort of a dynamic and expansionist imperial power. Not sure we would necessarily regard those as marvelous things today, and whether they were in the long-term interests of Spain, which lost most of its empire in 1898, I'm not sure. But it certainly isn't the sign of a completely derelict society.
You anticipated the question I had, which was, why did the Second Spanish Republic in the 1930s fail?
Well, that's again an excellent question. I mean, I've tried to write about that quite carefully, and obviously the trouble is the subject is shot through with ideological suppositions. I think one of the problems is that neither the right nor the left really understood the notion that a republic does mean you don't always get your own way, and that elections do mean that. I think that that was a major problem. But it's also worth bearing in mind, here again, we need to put it in its context. If you're looking at Europe in the 1930s, democracy fails in most states. And I mean, 1920s and 30s, even more so. And if you're thinking about other Catholic states, one would obviously be thinking of Italy, Poland, and Portugal. Obviously, France is different. So that, again, rather than treating Spain, you cited Raymond Carr, rather than treating Spain as some appalling outlier, I mean, I'm not sure I would be happy with that view. I mean, it was tragic what happened in Spain, absolutely tragic. And I think the political and military leadership of the country served it very, very, very poorly. And here I think one should be talking both of the nationalists, the far right, and also, I'm afraid to say, I don't think the communists, or indeed many of the many of the left as a whole was sensible. I mean, for example, you know, anti-clerical legislation, anti-clerical practice was not a good idea in a society that was divided in that fashion. So, you know, I think the Second Republic found it very difficult to entrench democracy. I mean, it did all sorts of things. It granted the right to vote to women. It It, you know, supported Catalan self-government, all of which I think today we would regard, I hope we would regard, as benign developments. But I think its political response to growing polarization, which was, you know, a reluctance to reach out to those of differing views, I think that was a major problem in a context that was being radicalized by falling living standards and by the extent to which both left and right were demonizing each other.
Why did General Franco win the Civil War?
Better operational practice, better logistics, a more united side as opposed to his opponents. All of those were important. He and his colleagues, he wasn't the only one who rose in 1936, got it badly wrong, of course. In 1936, they did not take over as they had anticipated doing. And, you know, you end up with this civil war. You know, in the context of both sides poorly trained, inadequately supplied, only limited experience, and also, of course, terrible transport infrastructure for both sides. I think in that context, the Francoists were more successful in organizing themselves to produce a cohesive military activity in which they used incrementalism very successfully, conquering one area after another. Their original plan, which was for a rapid victory, went badly wrong. But once the war became intractable, as it appeared, their kind of deliberative and incrementalist fashion did work out in the end. I mean, it took quite a time, but it did work out. I mean, the Republicans didn't govern very well. They couldn't feed their population, raise their revenue, control their inflation, run their military logistics. All of those were important.
Do you agree with scholars like Stanley Payne, who argue that notwithstanding all its flaws, au fond, the Franco regime was a modernizing one?
Stanley Payne's a great scholar. Can I just say, I think the Francoist regime by the mid to late 60s is totally different to the Francoist regime in the 1940s. In the 1940s, I would put the emphasis much more on repression and a, you know, almost suffocating reactionary characteristics. And I wouldn't see much form of modernization then. But I think you get the development of more technocratic policies. And there is in the 60s and early 70s, I think what you could see liberalization, economic growth, social change, things like the liberalization of censorship by the press law of, I think it's 1966. I think economics, it's the stabilization plan of 1959. So there is an industrial takeoff in the 60s, which owes a lot to technocrats and to the so-called long boom of the Western economy. And that tests the traditional Catholic nationalism of the Francoist regime, which had been there and much more coercively present in the 40s and the 50s.
How overdetermined in a structural sense was the relatively peaceful, except of course in terms of Basque terrorism, was the Spanish transition from Francoism to democracy? Or was it more of a case of contingency?
Well, I think contingency is definitely plays a role. I mean, most obviously in the 1981 attempt to stage a coup. Fortunately, that was unsuccessful, though there is evidence that that it was a more broadly based policy, that the king's confidant, General Armada, possibly a member of the coup, wanted to head what he called a salvation government. And so that is an element one needs to think about. I think it was easier. It was a much easier transition than in the case of Portugal. Much easier. Portugal, after the Caetano regime fell shortly beforehand, had a much more tricky transition in 74, 75 into 76. So I think from that, and it's worth bearing in mind that elsewhere in Europe, the late 70s and early 80s were not exactly easy years. You know, it's the period of the Red Brigade in Italy, the Baader-Meinhof, etc., etc., etc. So there are all sorts of problems and issues to address as far as that is concerned. But yes, I think it can be overplayed. I mean, Juan Carlos is presented as a transitional figure, able to reconcile oil. Well, that does depend upon all being willing to be reconciled. And you yourself have drawn attention to the Basques, who, of course, blew up Franco's designated successor, Admiral Carrero Blanco, in Madrid in December 1973, you know, which was scarcely a sort of a peaceful transition of power sort of scenario.
Do you agree with Sir John Eliot in his book dealing with Catalan nationalism that the Catalan intelligentsia has had a baneful influence by virtue of their myth-making in terms of Catalan history?
Well, I mean, you know, John Eliot's very committed to a Spanish viewpoint. I think... What's interesting is this, and you know, here we are. We're in a world in which you have nationalisms that have emerged in the shadows of empire, and where they succeed, Irish or Finnish or Polish, we held them up for exemplary activity, and where they fail, they're treated as pathologies, which of course has been the fate of the Catalans at the hands of the Spanish state repeatedly. I think I'm not so convinced as John is that there's this easy distinction between the goodies and the baddies. Now, you might say that's an unfair caricaturing of his views, but I don't think it is, actually. I mean, he has looked at the comparison between Catalonia and Scotland. And, you know, I mean, I myself would prefer Scotland to stay within the Union. But if Scotland wishes to be independent and the majority of Scots vote for it, then, you know, in a democratic society, one should be prepared to accept that. And I have to say, one contrasts, you know, the Cameron government, as we all know, cack-handed and incompetent. But at least in 2014, the referendum in Scotland was something that was accepted by the Westminster Parliament. A structure was put in place for it. Nobody was arrested. Nobody was put into prison. The matter was addressed peacefully. And I don't think that the Spanish system has responded so well to Catalonia. Yes, of course, there's always myth-making in nationalism. And yes, of course, that's why people like myself who talk about relativism and contingency and complexity are deeply unpopular with many so-called public intellectuals who like clarity as long as it's their clarity and like progressivism as long as it's their progressivism. But I'm uneasy. I mean, I myself cannot see why, if you have a European Union with states with a relatively modest population in them, such as Denmark or Finland, let alone places like Luxembourg, why on earth Catalonia, if it wishes to have independence, should not have independence? The fact that they might invent a history to that purpose and end, well, big deal. So have most societies invented histories. And as you know, I've written, I think, 3 books in all on people's accounts of the past history wars, the extent to which, as it were, myth-making takes place. And no, it can be easy to make fun of it. I'm not trying to make fun of it. I think what it reflects is the often desperate search for a sense of identity in a complex world. And searches for identity always involve fiction. I mean, you ask any person to provide an account of their life and you will know you are hearing something which reflects both fiction, but also a desperate sense to provide meaning to what they see there. So, you know, it's not surprising that that a society, a state, a culture, a people, whatever term you wish to use, has the same characteristics.
If you wanted people to take one thing away from your book, what would it be?
Oh, Spain is very well worth reading. But when you, sorry, Spain is very well worth visiting. But when you go to Spain, look, I mean, I'm fascinated by public history. Look and see how the public history is displayed and discussed. Look and see what the squares are named after. Look and see what statuary is there. Look and see how the local history is depicted. All of that is fascinating because it is a really interesting but very complex and very multifaceted society, more so, for example, than Portugal, which, you know, which I like enormously. And what else would I like people to get from the book? Well, what I've tried to capture is what I try to capture in all my books, which is the interaction between what happened in the past and how at every period, past and present, and dare I say future, we will be providing accounts of the past, and how the interplay of those is really both fascinating and, as you correctly mentioned when you were talking about Catalonia, tremendously important.
I would like to thank you very much, Professor Black, for being so kind and speak with us today. This is Charles Cotillo. Thanks for listening to New Books in History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. Thank you, Professor Black.
Thank you very much, and best wishes.